the mark on the board that we have a few handouts over here on the table, and it looked like a few left there. We just brought 100. We weren't sure how many to bring in. All of those are photocopies out of Times and Seasons. Now, there are other chronological works that some of you may know about and enjoy reading and studying. I think, frankly, that's my favorite. And I believe of course, it's written later in 1961. And the brother writing this, I believe, felt that Christ was going to come in 1972. But there's not a great deal of the material in the book that labors that point too much. And many of you have the book. I don't think it's available in print. I've got a copy here. And it's the way this book is bound, you might see it here. It's very flat, and you can take it to a copying place very easily and get copies. In fact, it's 300 pages, and at a nickel a copy, you could copy it cheaper than you could buy it. So, but it's a little more difficult to thumb through should you use it. But we're not going to get into too much, or any maybe, chronological numbers or figures until tomorrow, Lord willing. There's a discipline to many things in life, and when we talk about numbers, or God's 7,000-year plan maybe can be very simple to some of us, and then it can be very elaborate depending on how dedicated we are in determining that there is exactly so many years from Daniel to the crucifixion and things like this, and when they started and when they end. So you got to discipline yourself to get your numbers just right in the Bible. And I have a little story to tell about the though maybe not too many of you are probably familiar with the Northeast, but the people who live in Maine have a kind of an accent and a down-home flavor, I guess. But they tell a story about the farmer up in Maine that was riding the train. Because there used to be a lot of small railroads like the Denver and Rio Grande, and this was the Bangor and Aroostook Railroad. Probably not many of you heard of that. But the fellow sat down on the train with his farmer, and they go a little distance out of Boston up to Maine. And they pass a herd of cattle, and the train's going about 60 miles an hour. And they go by this herd, and this farmer says to his friend, he says, do you know how many cattle in that herd? He says, no. He says, well, there was 175. So the train goes on a little further, and they speeding right along. They pass another herd of cattle. He says, you know how many cattle over in that herd? And he says, no. He says, well, there was 220. So they go a little further and pass some more cattle. Farmer says the same thing. He says, there was 240 cattle in that herd. And this fellow says, wait a minute. He says, how when this train is zipping by so fast, can you count those cattle and tell me how many are there? He says, it's easy. He says, you just count their legs and divide by four. But I'll tell you, I think the numbers when we deal in chronology are tougher than that. I also forgot to tell you that if you have any questions, that I'm able to answer all of them. But unfortunately, about 90% of my answers will be, I don't know. We spoke a little bit yesterday about attitude. And again, attitude doesn't perhaps involve itself with chronology and the study of the development of God's plan, but I'd like to reemphasize that, and the reason I'm doing this is because currently we see that some people get very upset, not just so much in the chronology of things, but in the interpretation of prophecy, and numbers are related to this, that if you don't see eye to eye with me, or with somebody else, that they're just forms a distance between people, and their attitude really is questionable. And a sister was telling me here, I'm not quite sure I got her point, and I don't want to embarrass her by giving her name. Her initials are Teddy Metzer. But she was saying, I believe it's about 7 years ago, that one of the brothers was speaking at one of the Bible schools and left the impression, at least, that if we don't know more or less the exact hour or exact day or exact timing of these things, that we're very derelict in our duties and we're just not the students that we ought to be, and there's just something wrong with us. And I think it's there, as are many other lessons in the Scriptures, to create an interest and keep us alive to the fact that God has a continuing plan and that we have the opportunity to be involved in it. There was a brother, I think it was 3 years ago, at one of the Bible schools, and I'm not sure how they operate here, but I like for the Bible schools to write to you 3 or 6 months ahead and says, we want you to speak Thursday night or Friday night or something. But this was where they tap you on the shoulder and says, we need somebody tonight. And this brother took his duties, I think, very seriously. And he said he had several talks that he'd given before or had worked on. He said he was going to, as I best recall it, was, I don't know how he cast lots or something, but he says he was going to leave this in the Lord's hand as to which talk he should give. And I forget how he picked out the one, but he was sort of saying that the Lord will guide me and pick out the talk that will be best for the hearers this particular evening. So I know he's very serious about what his responsibilities were. It so happened that in his talk, because I've got the tape of the thing and I've heard it it's a very good talk, and he wasn't criticizing or lambasting the pioneers, but there's been such a friction between the brothers that if you don't agree with this pioneer or that pioneer, that again, there's something wrong with you. And he says, you know, the pioneers are Moses and Paul and David and this type of individuals that we read about in the Scriptures. And I think all of us here, and probably there, agreed that really is our substance. So if Brother Thomas or Brother Williams or Brother Andrew or somebody else says, this is my interpretation of something in 1 Samuel or 2 Samuel, that is the best evidence that they can draw in their opinions related to all the other Scriptures. But the real basis is Moses, David, Solomon, Malachi, and others that we talk about. Well, I'm not privy to all the details, but of course we all exaggerate our stories. And it says before he sort of sat down even, that one of the dissidents was on his way out to the telephone phoning headquarters saying, here's a brother over here criticizing the pioneers. And he had no such intention. But people take such opposition one way or the other. And if I criticize Brother Thomas, or I don't criticize him, if I disagreed with his interpretation that Christ was going to come in 1868, I don't have to be smart. And I'm not trying to say I'm smarter than Brother Thomas and any of us here that were the same position. And we all have said Brother Thomas would be the first one to step forward and says that thing needs a new interpretation. We missed it. Brother Thomas gave the creation date as 4089 B.C., but he was consistent in that he felt that the millennium would start in 1905. Now, if you'll take those two numbers and add them together and subtract the one for the change from B.C. to A.D., I nearly need to do it on the board. I think you come out to 59, somebody quicker than I am on figuring this up, 1905 and 5994, I believe. So we're saying, well, that's not 6,000 years. But Brother Thomas felt, and I don't know where he got the idea, that he believed very strongly in the rebellion at the end of the 1,000 years, and he ascribed 6 years to that. I do have a little overhead on that. Most of you have seen this. I'll put that up a little higher. You've seen this diagram. That's in a. Does it give the page on there? Page 109 in Volume 1 of Eureka. And those of you who have some of the earlier monthly periodicals of Brother Thomas, he also had that drawing in the Herald of the Kingdom or something about in the 1850s. First volume of Eureka was started in about 1859, I believe, 1858 or 59. I don't know whether this is original with him, but this is his idea of the aeon of sin and death, or 7,000 years. And you'll notice this little six over here, and that's the six, I guess, that fills out the 6,000 years. This sort of circle on the end of his diagram is the Olam and Beyond, or I suppose the eighth day, the Hebrew term there. And he goes on, of course you can read a little bit about what he says about it, but I've just taken a pencil and added these figures together to show that he comes up to 7,000. And that little six in there is the figure he needs to fill out the, in other words, I guess he's saying the millennium goes to 6994, and then this other 6 years fills out the 7,000. But please, brothers and sisters, don't let us argue and fuss and have a distaste or a dislike for each other if we disagree on some of the interpretations of various prophecies. I also have a note, which I guess we could say is in the form of a question from the group, that I mentioned yesterday. Well, I'll read what he says. As you mentioned in class this morning, that would be yesterday, that you believe the seventh day is rest without a period of war at the beginning, as Brother Thomas taught, I have a question. If the kingdom age is peace, with increase in peace as taught in Isaiah 9:7, also, neither shall they learn war anymore, and so forth, do you believe the rebellion is in the eighth day as an antitype of circumcision, which would be after the millennial reign or the seventh day, which would then require the rebellion to be during the God all in all period? Please explain. That's one of them I might have to say I don't know. I went back to the only place that the rebellion, there, of course, some believe there will be and some believe there won't be, is taught as the, or is inferred, we'll say, is the 20th chapter of Revelation. And maybe I should turn there. But there's a little phrase in there. I guess it depends. There's several verses you've got. You can't just pick it out of a half a verse. It talks about 1,000 years. Now, I don't know how many of you go back as far as I do, but it was in, I guess it's in the late 20s. I wasn't there, but the book was written by Brother A.H. Zilmer on the binding of Satan, which dealt with this chapter. And his idea was that there was 1,000 years that began back about the year 1000, so that this 1,000 years, it says, when they are expired, would bring us down to about our day. So he did not see a rebellion, and I don't recall all of his arguments. So he sees a different 1,000 years. I see the 1,000 years in Revelation 20 as the millennial seventh day. But it says in verse 7, when the 1,000 years are expired. Now that would say to me, they're all over. You know, not 69, 95, or 96, but 7,000 years are the end of that seventh day. Then certain things are going to happen. It says Satan is loosed out of his prison, which is the rebellion idea. But the brother has a good question, because many people feel that the number 7, meaning or suggesting perfectness, that the eighth day is also a symbol of perfectness, and that if we carry over into the eighth day rebelliousness and nations ganging up on each other and that type of thing, we may have a problem in supporting our theory. We're not here to talk about the rebellion, but I think that people should be able to. You may say one thing and I may say another, and we say, well, we just disagree with each other. But I think there's an idea that this rebellion in the minds of people is so large and on such a scale that the kingdom has failed, that the 7,000 years just have failed to bring about what God has intended. I can perceive very easily that the rebellion is just a small skirmish in which the final evidence of sin is washed out and done away with. And I don't think I'll comment anymore. Somebody might want to bring it up at one of the round table discussions. But brethren should not compete with each other. This is a Bible principle. There's a race to be run, but one person doesn't win as the races we see in the athletic field today. One is a winner, and one second place, and one third place. All brethren can win the race, and they're not competing with each other. In fact, they're helping, or should be helping, each other. And there's another story I want to tell, and it's not so humorous. I told this story in a meeting in Richmond, and one of the mothers says, which is typical of a lot of mothers, they're interested in their children. I think her daughter was about 12, and she said, well, what did you learn, or something about, did you pay attention today, and or what did Brother Jim have to say? And she says, I don't know, but something about a donut. So that's all she got. But there's a little donut story I want to tell. It could be anything other than a donut, but there was a man that came into town, and he opened up a donut shop on the corner. Put up his greatest donuts in the world, and waited for business. So pretty soon another man came along, two or three houses down the street. He puts up another donut shop. He says, puts his sign up, says, greatest donuts in the universe. So he opened and waited for a little business. Pretty soon a third fella came along, went a little further down the block. He opens up a donut shop and says, greatest donuts on this block. So that does have a moral overtone, I hope, that if we're trying to be the greatest Christadelphian or brother in the world, or we're trying to outstrip somebody else, I'm better than he is, I know more, I'm more advanced, I'm more this, I'm more that, he's really got the wrong idea. And we don't want to harbor this at all. We want to be the kind of people that says that I'm the best person I can be working with what I've got. I'm not competing with anybody else, and the Lord certainly is going to take notice of our attitudes toward this. We had another, to sort of give an illustration of this, and fortunately there's not many people here from Richmond. We're like any ecclesia. We have our good points and bad points. I can say I've lived 22 years in Richmond, and I've enjoyed the association and the studies and the ecclesial activities. And I haven't got that much criticism on that point, but people will get upset and get into arguments. We got into a discussion and an argument about John 3:16, which is a verse everybody in the world knows, even in Christendom. God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him might not perish, but have everlasting life. Well, what is the world? That was the argument came up. Does God love all these Muslims and all the Russians and all the South Americans and everybody else? Is that what we're talking about? Or is it just the household? Because one side says, you know, can you imagine God loving? I remember their argument, which is not my argument. You think God loved all these people who were bobbing up and down when the flood came in Noah's time? Is that love? Is that the love of God that we're talking about, that he gave his only begotten Son for? Well, the word for world there is cosmos, which is, in my mind, it means the whole of humanity. And of course, I'm maybe trying to sell a point here too. If you have the other thoughts, you may. I'm not giving you a chance to rebuke what I say, but Christ died for some stranger out here that we don't even know, because his salvation is available. Should that person learn who he is and what the effect of his coming and his atonement work was, so his love is available for any and every person, in my mind at least, that's ever lived. But it's not so much that, well, you see it differently, or somebody else sees it differently, but it's that I'm suddenly labeled as some kind of an apostate or some kind of a bad actor if I just can't see it that way. My point is not so much to prove John 3:16 means one thing or another, but it's that we have respect for each other and try to get along and realize that we're all working, or should be working, toward the same end. I'm not going over this thing probably until tomorrow. Well, let me back up a little bit. It's put together starting at page 207 in this book, and it skips several pages, of course, but it gives us the chronology. On the first page, 207, then it goes into the second period, and the third period, and the fourth period. So if we go through all of these various chronological periods, we should start with Adam and end with either the coming of Christ or the end of the seventh day, depending on how far we go. Those last pages with the little black marks across them are difficult for me to read. But they take you from the first table on through 30-some-odd tables, giving you the chronology down to the, I believe, to the end of the 6,000 years. So we will sort of scan those, if you will, tomorrow. Today, yesterday we stopped off on the slight consideration of the first chapter of Genesis, and we mentioned that there, on the various days, certain things were created. We feel that this fourth day, we're going to just mention a little bit about it, about the sun, moon, and stars, that possibly that represents the birth of Christ. And his birth in roughly 4 B.C. would be 4,000 years, or at the very terminal point of the fourth millennial day. Now our assumption is that all 7 days in Genesis 1 represent God's larger plan to stretch out the opportunity of salvation over this period of time. Now, if you ask me what the divided waters refer to, is that Abraham or David or somebody else or certain things going on, I'm not prepared to discuss it at this point. But I do believe, and I'm offering it for your belief, that the 7,000-year plan of God has its basis on the creation data that are given in Genesis 1. In the first verse of Genesis 1, it says, "In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. I don't know how many of us feel that the beginning was 6,000 years ago or 5994, whatever we're in today, or that we feel that beginning was ages before then. I believe the second verse of Genesis 1 says, at the time, following this statement that God made, in the beginning, he created heaven and earth, and this was Moses' writing, and Moses lived nearly 1,600 plus years later, so it must have been divinely given to Moses to write this account. He wasn't there in Eden, and of course, the inspiration of the scriptures in many cases is given to a person years after those events happen, showing again that it is the divine mind that's recorded here, not some person's personal experience. Even though we can read in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John that they observed certain things that Christ did and all. Again, that was the Creator's choice to record those from an eyewitness viewpoint in that situation. We get to Revelation. It says the revelation of Jesus Christ, which he gave. Of course, Christ at that point had been dead for 60 years, but it was his duty or job or arrangement by God to present this information to the Apostle John so that he could pass it on to readers of the Bible that their strength in spiritual things might be helped, because God knew that from 96 on, we've been 1900 years now, that there would be believers and that they would need certain items to strengthen their faith. And it is so written. But the earth was without form and void, and there's a variety of words. I've got the word waste written down here. It was in a shambles at this origin. And then it began, as we talked about the 6 days, it began to be formed into a shape, the waters, the earth, the dry land, the creatures, and so forth. It's not going to be very successful, but I'm going to ask for a sort of a show of hands. I want your choice of three things. One answer is I don't know, or I don't have an opinion. Two is I believe that the earth is only 6,000 years old, that at the inception of Genesis 1 was 6,000 years ago, and God took some particles or something and formed it. And number three is that the earth very likely existed for ages and ages before the Adamic era. How many are uncertain or don't know or don't have an opinion? All right, there's a few. I'll say 8 or 10. How many feel that it's only 6,000 years old? About two or three. That's very few. How many feel like it went ages beyond the Adamic? Predominantly, that would be the number. But that doesn't, you know, you don't win a vote by a number of hands. If I took the same vote and I says, how many believe in the immortality of the soul, and it was unanimous, would that make it right? Certainly wouldn't. We'd be unanimously wrong. So you can't, and that's a point to remember, that we, right is not always determined by the majority. But in this case, it seems that those who have studied and considered and given their mental energies to this feel like that there was some kind of an existence or arrangement. And this certainly is not first principle. We don't say to a person, in order for you to be baptized, you've got to explain to me all the strata and the details of this habitable upon which we live. The words in the margin for without form and void are two Hebrew words, tohu and bohu, T-O-H-U and B-O-H-U, and apparently describe the condition at this beginning, and it's my opinion too, I'm going with the majority, that in the beginning means sometime before the Adamic era. I can't tell you it was 1,000 years or 1,000,000 years. And of course, the evolutionists they need millions of years to support their theories. They can't tell you that man, coming from some uncreated source, lived for 3,000 years before the Bible account or something like that. They need millions and millions, which confuses people. In other words, we can't question somebody who has the genius to say, 2 billion years ago something happened and finally man evolved or a certain form of life that preceded man. But I don't believe it says or infers in this verse that the world was created in this form of waste or uninhabitable condition. But in the beginning, God created the earth. It may have gone through some other life forms or what have you that we just don't know. In Isaiah 45:18, the same word, somebody stop me if I'm wrong. I believe this is Tohu. Let's read it and see. For thus saith the Lord that created the heavens, God himself that formed the earth and made it, he hath established it. He created it not in vain. He formed it to be inhabited. I am the Lord. I think that's just a verse I jotted down here to show that God had a reasonable and an intelligent purpose in forming this earth. Even though it starts off in Genesis 1 as uninhabitable, the purpose of God in these 6 days of arrangement were to make it habitable. And it wasn't just so we'd have a nice countryside to look at or to sit down in or anything like that. The whole idea is expressed in this verse. It's not in direct language, but when he says, I am the Lord, he's saying, for this habitable which man is going to live in, I want him not only to have an environment in which he can survive, but I want him to have a spiritual perception in which he'll know the Lord created it, and therefore the Lord has a purpose, which is, again, is stretching over a certain number of years, and that is his intent. Look at 2 Peter 3 and verses 5 and 6. For this they willingly are ignorant of, that by the word of God the heavens were of old, and the earth standing out of the water and in the water, whereby the world that then was, being overflowed with water, perished. We've moved down the stream of time here to Noah's time, 1,656 years, I believe. And again, God is saying here, inferentially only, that the earth, and the word world is also used, cosmos here, that they have a purpose, that God is continuing on and on. He started with Adam, he's now down to Noah, and he's going to go on. We have other evidences of this, that, of course, the rainbow that was presented in Genesis states that God will not again destroy this cosmos or order of things by means of a flood. He's going to change it. The next revolution or evolution, whichever we want to call it, is going to be by fire. And I think we all probably feel that will be the great warfare when Christ comes and the nations are blotted out to a great extent, and the remainder will form the nucleus of the kingdom. The word tohu, it's used 21 times in the Old Testament. It means such words or expressions as confusion, empty place, nothing, naught, thing of naught, vanity, waste, wilderness, vain, without form. Of course, that was the translation in Genesis 1:2, without form. So the whole idea is that there was no semblance of I don't want to say sanity, but no livable arrangement in the original state. The word bohu, I think, is only used about three times in the Bible, and it means emptiness and void. So it's translated void in Genesis. I think we get the idea that we have here an expanse of material, earth and water, I suppose, that needed organization and shaping, and God did. And once he did, we begin our process of life that's going to extend through 6,000 years of man's dominion and 1,000 years of the reign of Christ. Now, there's an account in Help Us Israel. I'll just refer this to you, pages 10 to 13, where Brother Thomas discusses this and in a very intelligent and profitable way. Particularly the work of the angels. I think it's reasonable to say that this arrangement of separating the water and the land and the hills and the trees and the fish and the plant life and all was literally done or certainly assisted in by angelic help. And, of course, the question arises, and it's not totally unprofitable, well, where did these angels come from? And I'm not going to take any vote on that. There are several references in the Scripture, you know, and I believe Brother Thomas mentioned these angels that sinned and left their first estate. Can somebody help me? Kept not their first estate. And for several years, I've heard people criticize. They said, well, Brother Thomas had the wrong idea. Maybe he did. One thing to justify the wonderful, wonderful writing that he's done in Help Us Israel is to realize that this man was emerging from all of the systems of Campbellism or orthodoxy, and to do what he did. As a single man, no help. He had literary help, and he probably visited the library more than you and I go to the dinner table. But no one here, or no one in their legitimate appraisal, should say that we don't owe a great, great deal of thanks for this provision that the deity has made. But for years I thought he said that these immortal angels sin and kept not their first estate. I looked at it. I'm not too clear on it right now. But he may have meant that in a previous age, before the Adamic era, that the rescued from that race are now the present immortal angels that are assisting in the regulation of this world's affairs. But that those who were not worthy and didn't keep their estate refers to a period of time before our 6,000 years. I don't know how, if there's anybody here that may... Well, is there anybody that has a little thought or comment that can correct me or add to what I've said? Well, you can think about it. As most of us know, angels... comes from the Greek, at least in the New Testament, meaning messenger or agent. And we have illustrations where sometimes these are mortal agents that God uses to appear on his behalf and do certain things. They're not always immortal angels that are invisible and immortal. In Matthew 25, again, that happens to be the reading for the day, there's a mention made in the 41st verse of the devil and his angels. So he has some assistants or helpers or people that he is using a figurative personification of the devil, has helpers, agents, messengers that work in a negative sense or against God. So the devil has angels. To Peter it was said in Acts 12:15, somebody didn't, they misunderstood or misapprehended the appearance of Peter, and somebody said, it is his angel. Again, meaning a representation of him. And in 1 Corinthians 6:3, I'm sure going to have to put this one out for a roundtable discussion, where it says, we, that is the saints, shall judge angels. If somebody were to ask me what that meant, I'll make a stab at it. I'll have to say, I certainly am not positive about this, that certainly we know there's evidence in the Scripture. It says Christ has obtained a more excellent name than the angels. He has a rank as God's only begotten Son and as the Savior of mankind over this 6,000-year period. To have a rank that is higher in the esteem of God than do the angels. Now, that doesn't mean that God dislikes the angels in any sense and that they are not utilizable and that they rejoiced at the acts of creation. They rejoice over one sinner that repenteth. So they're in concert with the deity. But if we are to judge angels, it could be, again, that the word angels may mean the agents or messengers that God has arranged for. And certainly in the kingdom there will be mortal nations there, and that the saints are to rule over one city, five cities, 10 cities, or something like this, and that they may judge or rule over angels in that sense. That would be certainly not immortal angels. I have a little difficulty in assigning saints to judge immortal angels. It's said of Christ that he was made a little lower than the angels. I feel confident I can answer that, but I'm going to ask somebody else. They don't have to agree with me, but I'm going to overrule them if they don't. What does it mean that Christ was made a little lower than the angels? Anybody want to volunteer that? Over here?
Well, I was just thinking that he was placed a little lower than the angels to be studied under them or to be ministered unto by them, to the point where his understanding was brought to an equal to them, and then from the time of the power of the Holy Spirit given to him, then he became over them. That's the way I would.
You're saying, I'm going to give you a shot, John. You're saying that Christ was formed, well, I'm adding or putting words in your mouth, that he was mortal for a while and the angels were superior, but
right,
that after he proved himself, he was superior. John, what did
That's
you
what
want to
say? I was going to say, he was mortal.
Yeah.
He was lower than the angels.
I believe there's a translation that helps there, and I don't know, I have, yeah, it is Hebrews 2:7, if you, and then, of course, Hebrews is.